Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 163. It's Monday, May 16th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, the COVID-19 pandemic still goes on, but in the long slog, fortunately, the reporting updates are getting a little bit shorter, but let's do some of that now, starting with news from the Associated Press. Pandemic gets tougher to crack as COVID testing plunges. Testing for COVID-19 has plummeted across the globe, making it much tougher for scientists to track the course of the pandemic and spot new, worrisome viral mutants as they emerge and spread. Experts say testing has dropped 70 to 90% worldwide, from the first to the second quarter of this year, the opposite of what they say should be happening with new Omicron variants on the rise in places such as the United States and South Africa. An influential modeling group at the University of Washington, Seattle, estimates that only 13% of cases are being reported to health authorities in the U.S., which would mean more than 500,000 new infections every day in America. The drop in testing is global, but the overall rates are especially inadequate in the developing world. The number of tests per 1,000 people in high-income countries is around 96 times higher than it is in low-income countries. Whew! So you thought we had problems. Next up, from Medical Express, health experts caution against, quote, new normal strategies for COVID-19. Researchers are warning U.S. leaders and health officials against national strategies for a, quote, new normal of life with COVID-19. The warning, published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, argues that talks of a new normal fail to incorporate important lessons from the first 2 years of the COVID-19 pandemic. First, the significant role of non-communicable chronic diseases in exacerbating COVID-19, and second, the disproportionate burden of COVID-19 on underserved populations and communities of color. Non-communicable chronic diseases are those that are not spread from person to person and persist for at least 1 year, such as diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. They are the leading causes of death worldwide and represent a global health threat that predates the COVID-19 pandemic. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the non-communicable disease crisis kills more than 15 million Americans prematurely each year. Together, the COVID-19 pandemic and the chronic disease crisis create what is called a synergistic endemic, or syndemic. There's your word for the day, folks. Syndemic. A synergistic endemic. Overlapping epidemics that interact, increasing the burden of disease and the likelihood of poor outcomes. Recent proposals for a new normal national strategy in the U.S. focuses too much on the SARS-CoV-2 virus and too little on the context in which the virus impact is most burdensome. What we really need is a comprehensive syndemic control strategy because, in truth, the pre-pandemic state of health in the U.S. was not ideal in the first place. This is evidenced by nearly 95% of U.S. adults hospitalized with COVID-19 between March 2020 and March 2021 had an underlying condition. Vaccinated people with breakthrough infections were 44 to 69% more likely to suffer severe outcomes if they had a chronic disease. Non-communicable diseases and risk behaviors such as smoking, substance abuse, and physical inactivity conferred a higher risk for severe COVID-19, according to the CDC, based on conclusive evidence. And in a prime example of how COVID-19 has devastated groups in the U.S., this is from NBC News. COVID-19 narrows long-standing Latino mortality advantage. Latinos have long had lower mortality rates compared to non-Hispanic whites, living more than 3 years longer in what many refer to as the Latino mortality paradox. That ended with the COVID-19 pandemic. Having killed more than 1 million people in the U.S., the coronavirus reshaped the nation's mortality patterns and the long-standing Latino mortality advantage, particularly among older Latinos, according to new research by the Lerner Center for Public Health Promotion at Syracuse University. COVID-19 killed Latinos aged 65 or older at over 2 times the rate of whites in 2020. That contributed to a decline in the Latino mortality advantage, which went down from 11% in the first year of the pandemic, the research found. In 2019, before the pandemic, the death rate among older Latino adults was 29% lower than it was for whites. So at the beginning of the pandemic, it was about 11%. In 2020, it was only 11% difference, a mortality advantage that older Latinos had. It was almost 30% prior to that, before the pandemic. That's almost a 2/3 drop. A peer-reviewed study published last month in the Journal of the American Medical Association revealed the life expectancy of Latinos in the U.S. decreased by nearly 4 years from 2019 to 2020. Most Latinos, regardless of age, have died of COVID-19 at a rate almost twice that of the country's white population. The agency, CDC, also lists COVID-19 as the top cause of death for Hispanics. For whites, COVID-19 is the third leading cause of death. I'll repeat that again. For Hispanics, COVID-19 has been the leading cause of death during the pandemic. Okay, next up from Axios. U.S. and world leaders pledge more than $3 billion to fight pandemic globally. The U.S. and other world leaders pledged last Thursday more than $3 billion in new funding to fight the pandemic globally at the Biden administration's second global COVID-19 summit. To this, I have this commentary. Yeah, folks, well, $3 billion is better than nothing, but better than nothing is a very low bar. Okay, well, in more news about things gone wrong with the COVID-19 pandemic, this from NBC News, more people now incorrectly blame Asian Americans for COVID than at the height of the pandemic. More Americans are now blaming Asian Americans for COVID-19 than at the height of the pandemic in 2021, according to a report by Asian American advocacy groups. More than 20% of respondents said this year that people of Asian descent are at least partly responsible for COVID, compared to 11% who said last year that the community was to blame. 33% of respondents said that people of Asian descent are more loyal to their perceived country of origin than the U.S., compared to 20% who said the same in 2021. It does stem from the perpetual foreigner myth that Asians and Asian Americans, no matter if you're born here or not, you're always seen as just from your country of origin. The study's findings are in line with other recent studies on the rise of anti-Asian hate, one of which showed a 339% increase in anti-Asian violence between 2020 and 2021. Still, nearly 1/3 of respondents said they didn't know that anti-Asian violence is getting worse. Many Asian American respondents, meanwhile, reported not feeling like they belong in the U.S. 29% of Asian Americans said that they fully belong and feel accepted in the U.S., compared to 61% of white respondents and 33% of black respondents. Asian Americans between the ages of 18 and 24 experienced even a lower sense of belonging at just 19%. Although I would note that even a 61% of white respondents feeling that they fully belong in this country gives you a little clue to the level of alienation in this country among all populations. Despite the lack of recognition of the hate of the Asian American community has been facing recently, more than 70% of all respondents said it's essential to combat anti-Asian racism. Well, in a somewhat related but unrelated story, North Korea has reported its first death, and in the meantime, in about the week that followed that from COVID-19, they're reporting hundreds and hundreds of thousands of cases, and their testing is terrible. Their population is completely unvaccinated. They refuse to accept vaccinations from the international community, China, a bunch of places. So it looks like things are going to get really bad. North Korea has a terrible hospital healthcare system. So, yikes. We'll have to see how that rolls out in the next few weeks. Okay, well, let's bring it closer to home and do the local COVID-19 update for Lucas County. Just to put it in context, nationally, COVID-19 cases have gone up by 60% in the last 2 weeks. And this just coming in today from a press release from the Toledo Lucas County Health Department. As of May 12th, Lucas County's cases were per 100,000 individuals was 264, an increase of 197% from the previous 2 weeks. So cases are rising. Looking at the weekly case rates, we went up to 118 per day on average reported, and that's up from 89 in the previous week. Note again that they're only doing weekly reporting, so it's much harder to track it in the short term. Okay, testing positivity rates are skyrocketing in Lucas County. They went up to 15.9% from 10.6% the previous week. Yikes, I'm not sure I've seen an increase that big in a long, long, long time. And we saw a slight decrease in testing. Testing is really at a low locally, nationally, in Ohio. We had a little blip upwards, but it's still hanging down at a very low level. Okay, Ohio's testing positivity rate went up to 11.9% from 8.5% the previous week, and in the U.S. went up to 10.3% from 8.6% in the previous week. And I'll remind my listeners that 5% positivity rate is considered halfway decent testing and a goal to seek, and we're double or triple that, depending what part of the country you're in. Okay, nursing homes. We saw an almost tripling of the number of active COVID cases in Lucas County long-term care facilities. We jumped from 14 active cases to 41 in the most recent week. And we had one more death among long-term care facility residents in the last week. And we had a long haul where we hadn't had any deaths, but we've had a couple deaths in the last couple weeks in these facilities. UT also saw a tick up of cases in but probably their last week of classes. 20 cases identified. Five of those were through the random surveillance testing, which was a 3.4% positivity rate for that testing, which is the highest they've had in a long time. So UT ends the year on a little higher note or a lower note, depending how you look at it. But it seems to be reflecting what's happening in the community. Cases are rising. And of course, when cases rise, hospitalizations rise, and that's what we're seeing in Lucas County, Ohio, and the U.S. In the last week, we saw a 24% increase in the number of people hospitalized in the U.S. and an even larger increase of 37% in Lucas County. In perhaps a little oddity of reporting, deaths nationally went down slightly. Now we're at just over 300 per day on average. Although I will point out, this is still an annualized rate of well over 100,000 deaths per year, which in my mind is nowhere even near the ballpark of acceptable. We can and should do better. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life, and I'm broadcasting from the John Snow Memorial Studio. Okay, well, I want to move on to some abortion coverage here, and I want to introduce this just by talking about what I would call the bookends to abortion, which is unplanned pregnancies, which of course lead folks into the position of wanting an abortion, and if you have a child or are contemplating having a child, the poor support for children and families that we see in most places in this country. So nearly half of U.S. pregnancies are unplanned, And states with the most abortion restrictions have the highest rates of unplanned pregnancies. This is not a good alignment, my friends. Okay, long-acting reversible contraceptives like intrauterine devices, IUDs, are the gold standard in contraceptive use. These long-acting reversible contraceptives are becoming more common and are often recommended by doctors because of their low failure rates, which is about 1% per year, and guaranteed contraceptive coverage for an extended period of time, most for up to 5 to 7 years after placement. These long-acting reversible contraceptive usage rates have not yet surpassed the pill, which remains the second most common birth control after sterilization. Okay, 38% of women will become pregnant within 5 years while using the birth control pill as their primary form of contraceptive. So while it's widely considered very effective, there is a large failure rate using it, particularly over a longer period of time, all those reproductive years. After 10 years of relying on the pill, 61% of women will become pregnant. For less effective methods, the failure rate is even higher. Condoms, if used over 10 years, have a cumulative failure rate of 86%. Investing in family planning saves $7 per dollar spent, but less than half of states guarantee access. This is a huge opportunity in public health that we are not taking advantage of. Okay, and of course, all of this is combined with the fact that half of women who have an abortion are living below the poverty line, over half already have children, and over half are experiencing a disruptive life event at the time, like losing a job, ending a relationship, or falling behind on rent. And the poverty thing is particularly harsh since a huge number of births in this country are under Medicaid. And for a woman who's on Medicaid who's pregnant, you have the Hyde Amendment, which prevents Medicaid from paying for an abortion. So you have to come up with other resources in order to get an abortion. This has been true for decades. So that is a huge barrier. Okay, well, in the end, nearly half of reproductive age women live in a state that's expected to ban or restrict abortion. Unfortunately, this neatly divides us, the U.S., in half. Okay, well, let's start reporting with one half of that bookend, the contraceptive thing. This from the Guttmacher Institute. Cost-related barriers prevent low-income U.S. women from using their preferred contraceptive method. Up to 40% of women with low incomes in the United States would use a different contraceptive method or would start using a method if costs were not a factor, according to a new Guttmacher Institute published in Contraception. National data from 2015 to 2019 suggests that 23% of low-income female contraceptive users would prefer to use a different method if costs were not an issue. Among women with low incomes not using contraceptives, 39% would prefer to use a method if not for cost-related barriers. All people, regardless of income, should be able to choose and use the contraceptive method that works for them, free from cost-related barriers, said Megan Cavanaugh, principal research scientist at the Guttmacher Institute. A person's ability to access the preferred contraception is an essential component of reproductive choice and decision-making. So, what does the medical profession think about these abortion restrictions? Well, we got one example here, this from Yahoo News. Leading medical journal warns, quote, women will die if Supreme Court overturns Roe. One of the world's oldest and most well-known medical journals published an editorial last Thursday warning that if the U.S. Supreme Court were to confirm Justice Samuel Alito's draft opinion to overturn Roe v. Wade, women will die. The fact is that if the U.S. Supreme Court confirms its draft decision, women will die, The Lancet said in its editorial. The justices who vote to strike down Roe will not succeed in ending abortion. They will only succeed in ending safe abortion. Alito and his supporters will have women's blood on their hands. The 199-year-old journal argues that Alito's, quote, shocking, inhumane, and irrational draft opinion utterly fails to consider the health of women today who seek abortion. Unintended pregnancy and abortion are a universal phenomena. Worldwide, around 120 million unintended pregnancies occur annually, the editorial stated. Of these, 3/5 end in abortion, And of these, some 55% are estimated to be safe. That is, completed using a medically recommended method and performed by a trained provider. That leaves 33 million women undergoing unsafe abortions, their lives put at risk because laws restrict access to safe abortion services. In the United States, The Lancet notes, Black women have an unintended pregnancy rate double that of non-Hispanic white women and a maternal mortality rate almost three times higher than that for white women. These sharp racial and class disparities need urgent solutions, not more legal barriers, the editorial said. If the court denies women the right to safe abortion, The Lancet concluded, it will be a judicial endorsement of state control over women, a breathtaking setback for the health and rights of women, one that will have global reverberations. Okay, well, as another consequence for impending abortion restrictions, this from Axios. Medical education on abortion could be erased in red states. A key piece of OB-GYN training, how to perform an abortion, could soon be stricken from medical schools' curriculums in states that make the practice illegal. Why it matters. A Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade would not only affect patients, but drastically alter medical education and force young doctors to find workarounds to develop a skill deemed essential by professional bodies. The implications for our field are devastating, Kavita Vinikar, assistant clinical professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, told Axios. The politicization of our field has made the public think of abortion as a very separate thing from reproductive care, when really it's very much intertwined in what we do. Abortion care is very much intertwined with miscarriage management, with pregnancy care, with overall reproductive care, she said. By the numbers, 128 of the roughly 300 U.S. OB-GYN residency programs in the United States are in states that are certain or likely to ban abortion if the Supreme Court strikes down Roe and eliminates a federal right to the procedure, according to a recently published study in obstetrics and gynecology. Of the roughly 6,000 residents in accredited OB-GYN programs, more than 2,600 or 44% are in states that are likely to ban abortion. Residency administrators already report stigma surrounding abortion has left only about 1 in 5 OB-GYN program graduates proficient in dilation and evacuation, a common second trimester procedure, according to a 2018 study in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Roughly 70% are adept performing first trimester aspiration or induction of labor for second and third trimester terminations, the study found. A 2020 study from Stanford University found that half of medical schools in the U.S. include no formal training or offer a single lecture on abortion-related topics. Abortion training isn't just for OB-GYNs, it's part of the training for family medicine, pediatrics, and emergency medicine. Further cutbacks in training could limit treatment for life-threatening conditions such as ectopic pregnancies, which comprise 1 to 2% of U.S. pregnancies. These are not rare exceptions. If you live in a city and you're covering emergency rooms, someone is going to come in with an ectopic pregnancy almost every night. It is extremely common. Research from UC San Francisco suggests that clinical educators arrange travel rotations to states where abortion still is legal, train patients to manage miscarriages, and have residents practice with anatomic models to prepare for the prospective decline in access to abortion. Yes, but travel rotations may not be feasible for the nearly half of all U.S. OB-GYN residents, so educators might need to explore more workarounds. Okay, well, part of the other issue bookending abortion is what are the consequences of unplanned or unwanted pregnancies coming to term when abortion restrictions take place. So this would be the economic and social consequences. This from Politico, Yellen. Banning abortion would be, quote, very damaging to U.S. economy. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen argued that banning abortion would be very damaging for the economy by reducing women's ability to balance their careers and their families. I believe that eliminating the right of women to make decisions about when and whether to have children would be had very damaging effects on the economy and would set women back decades, she said in response to a question at a Senate Banking Committee hearing. In her comments, Yellen said that the 1973 ruling helped allow women to finish school and increase their earning potential, leading to higher participation in the workforce. Research also shows that it had favorable impact on the well-being and earnings of children, she said. There are many research studies that have been done over the years looking at the economic impacts of access or lack thereof to abortion, and it makes clear that denying women access to abortion increases their odds of living in poverty or need for public assistance. Yep, so the bottom line is it's bad for the women, and it's bad for children born into conditions that are less than favorable. Okay, well, I want to switch gears, and I want to do a story on a topic that I've covered a lot, which is supply shortages that COVID-19 has instituted. But this particular story got me to do a little bit of research on another public health issue, which I will tell you at the end what that is. Here we go, from the Washington Post. COVID shutdowns in China are delaying medical scans in the U.S. Doctors in the United States are prioritizing only the most critical patients, and hospitals are rationing supplies of a crucial drug after COVID lockdown in China temporarily closed a GE healthcare factory that is a vital source for a key ingredient in medical imaging. The shutdown of the facility in Shanghai in April halted production of contrast media, an iodine solution that medical staff inject into blood vessels to allow a device such as a CT scanner or fluoroscope to see inside the body. Contrast media, also known as dye, is used virtually every hour in hospitals across the country to help measure arterial blockages around the heart, guide placement of stents and catheter labs, diagnose and treat strokes, and more. Oncologists use contrast to monitor cancerous tumors. GE Healthcare told hospital officials that capacity at the plant was 25% this week, and that it expects to have supplies flowing normally again by the end of June. It has shifted production to a plant in Ireland and is flying shipments to the United States to speed delivery. But getting through the next 6 to 8 weeks could be difficult for local health systems reeling under the sudden supply shortage. Postponement notices for non-emergency appointments are already going out to patients. This disruption, which began to unfold in the past several weeks, reveals once again how overseas, poorly diversified supply chains are vulnerable to a global health crisis. Shortages have crippled the U.S. health system again and again in the past 2 years. So, of course, this is bad news, but this gives a little insight into how my mind works. I am very skeptical of much of our health care. And like I like to joke, you know, a hospital is no place for a sick person. There's a lot of what they call nosocomial infections or diseases, which are basically hospital-induced conditions. And I'll report a little bit more on that a little bit later in the show. But this got me wondering, less CAT scans, is that totally a bad thing? So maybe there's a little bit of a silver lining, and I did a little research, and you're going to hear it now. First of all, there's 80 million plus CAT scans that are done each year in the U.S. That's the most common scanning that's done. And the important thing about CAT scans is CAT scans use ionizing radiation, which is dangerous, and about 25% of these CAT scans are considered unnecessary. So with that context, I'll read a paragraph from the FDA page talking about what are the radiation risks from CT, that is CAT scans. This is from the FDA. The risk of developing cancer as a result of exposure to radiation depends on the part of the body exposed, the individual's age at exposure, and the individual's gender. For the purpose of radiation protection, a conservative approach that is generally used is to assume that the risk for adverse health effects from cancer is proportional to the amount of radiation dose absorbed, and that there is no amount of radiation that is completely without risk. This conservative approach is called the linear non-threshold model. The amount of dose depends on the type of X-ray examination. A CAT scan examination with an effective dose of 10 millisieverts may be associated with an increase in the possibility of fatal cancer of approximately one chance in 2,000. And this is sort of in the middle. There's depending where you do the scan and stuff, the amount of radiation you get. But this is sort of in the middle and ballpark. For some of the most common CAT scans, this would be representative. So they're saying approximately a 1 in 2,000 chance of a fatal cancer from a single CAT scan. Okay, this increase in the possibility of a fatal cancer from radiation can be compared to the natural incidence of fatal cancer in the U.S. population, about one chance in five, which equals 400 chances in 2,000 over a lifetime. In other words, for any one person, the risk of radiation-induced cancer is much smaller than the natural risk of cancer. I'll talk about natural in a sec. If you combine the natural risk of a fatal cancer and the estimated risk from a 10 millisievert CT scan, the total risk may increase from 400 chances in 2000 to 401 chances in 2000. Nevertheless, this small increase in radiation-associated cancer risk for an individual can become a public health concern if large numbers of people undergo increased numbers of CAT scan screening procedures of uncertain benefit. Okay, well, this is a really good example of it's very hard to understand risk, particularly when you're talking these kind of small things like 1 in 2,000 doesn't seem like very much. But like they're saying, when you do large numbers across entire populations, the numbers start getting significant. But I think they made a real mistake here in combining this so-called natural risk, which would be the sum of all causes of cancer, which is far from natural. And of course, that's about 400 out of 2,000, a 1 in 5 chance over your lifetime of getting a fatal cancer. But if you're comparing, for instance, this CAT scan here with 10 millisieverts, kind of a representative CAT scan, that amount of radiation is equal to 2 or 3 years of background radiation, which is really what the primary natural radiation that you're getting from both the sun and from the earth, which radiates small amounts of radiation that you're being hit with all the time. So one CAT scan would be the equivalent of a couple years or so of background radiation. Now, remember, we're doing 80 million of these a year, so it adds up really fast. Okay, well, let's take a look at that. So this is from the CDC, an update on cancer deaths in the United States. What were the leading causes of cancer death in 2020? Lung cancer was the leading cause of cancer death, accounting for 23% of all cancer deaths. Other common cancer deaths were cancers of the colon and rectum, 9%, pancreas, 8%, female breast, 7%, prostate, 5%, and liver, 5%. Other cancers individually accounted for less than 5% of cancer deaths. So in 2020, 136,000 people died of lung cancer, about 52,000 people died of colorectal cancer, about 47,000 people died of pancreatic cancer, about 42,000 people died of breast cancer, about 33,000 people died of prostate cancer, and about 28,000 people died of liver cancer. Okay, so if you take this 1 in 2,000 chance of a fatal cancer, and you multiply that by 80 million per year, this 1 in 2,000 lifetime cancer risk, that means these 80 million CT scans would cause about 40,000 fatal cancer deaths a year. Now, of course, the death that it doesn't cause the death in that year, it causes some future time, but over time, the cumulative effect. And that is hardly insignificant. If you're looking at 40,000 deaths per year caused, that's similar right now to what breast cancer is at 42,000 and more than what prostate cancers deaths each year there are at about 33,000. So hardly insignificant. So if you're getting a CT scan, ask your doctor if it's completely necessary and if there's other scans that are less invasive, meaning not having ionizing radiation, that perhaps could be done. Of course, remembering that about 25% of the CT scans are considered medically unnecessary. Okay, well, next up from Medical Express, we have a story that falls under the category of mystery solved. Genetic study confirms sarin nerve gas as the cause of Gulf War illness. For 3 decades, scientists have debated the underlying cause of Gulf War illness, a collection of unexplained and chronic symptoms affecting veterans of the Persian Gulf War. Now, researchers led by Robert Haley, professor of internal medicine and director of the Division of Epidemiology at University of Texas Southwestern, has solved the mystery, showing through a detailed genetic study that the nerve gas sarin was largely responsible for the syndrome. The findings were published in Environmental Health Perspectives, a peer-reviewed journal supported by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, with an accompanying editorial on the paper by leading environmental epidemiologists. Dr. Haley's research group not only discovered that veterans with exposure to sarin were more likely to develop Gulf War illness, but also found out the risk was modulated by a gene that normally allows some people's bodies to better break down the nerve gas. Gulf War veterans with a weak variant of the gene who were exposed to sarin were more likely to develop symptoms than other exposed veterans who had the strong form of the gene. Quite simply, our findings prove that Gulf War illness was caused by sarin, which was released when we bombed Iraqi chemical weapons storage and production facilities, said Dr. Haley, a medical epidemiologist who has been investigating Gulf War illness for 28 years. There are still more than 100,000 Gulf War veterans who are not getting help for this illness, and our hope is that these findings will accelerate the search for better treatment. In the years immediately following the Gulf War, more than a quarter of U.S. and coalition veterans who served in the war began reporting a range of chronic symptoms, including fatigue, fever, night sweats, memory and concentration problems, difficulty finding words, diarrhea, sexual dysfunction, and chronic body pain. Since then, both academic researchers and those within the military and Department of Veterans Affairs have studied a list of possible causes of Gulf War illness, ranging from stress, vaccinations, and burning oil wells to exposure to pesticides, nerve gas, anti-nerve gas medication, and depleted uranium. Sarin is a toxic man-made nerve agent, first developed as a pesticide, that has been used in chemical warfare. Its production was banned in 1997. When people are exposed to either the liquid or gas form, sarin enters the body through the skin or breathing and attacks the nervous system. High-level sarin often results in deaths, but studies on survivors have revealed that lower-level sarin exposure can lead to long-term impairment of brain function. The U.S. military has confirmed that chemical agents, including sarin, were detected in Iraq during the Gulf War. In particular, satellite imagery documented a large debris cloud rising from an Iraqi chemical weapons storage site bombed by the U.S. and coalition aircraft and transiting over U.S. ground troop positions, where it set off thousands of nerve gas alarms and was confirmed to contain sarin. There is no other risk factor coming where any close to having this level of causal evidence for Gulf War illness, said Dr. Haley. So there you go. A decades-long mystery solved. Still much work to be done in the treatment, though. And, of course, teaching us one more lesson of the ways that war is very dangerous. Okay, next up from Stat News, U.S. overdose dose deaths hit record 107,000 in 2021, CDC says. More than 107,000 Americans died of drug overdoses last year, setting another tragic record in the nation's escalating overdose epidemic, the CDC estimated last Wednesday. The 2021 total translates to roughly one U.S. overdose death every 5 minutes. It marked a 15% increase from the previous record set the previous year. U.S. overdose deaths have risen most years in more than two decades. The increase began in the 1990s with overdoses involving opioid painkillers, followed by waves of deaths led by other opioids like heroin and, most recently, illicit fentanyl. Last year, overdoses involving fentanyl and other synthetic opioids surpassed 71,000, up 23% from the year before. There was also a 23% increase in deaths involving cocaine and a 34% increase in deaths involving meth and other stimulants. Overdose deaths are often attributed to more than one drug. Some people take multiple drugs, and inexpensive fentanyl has been increasingly cut into other drugs, often without buyer's knowledge. The net effect is that we have many more people, including those who use drugs occasionally, and even adolescents, exposed to these potent substances, which can cause someone to overdose, even with a relatively small dose. And regarding the world's favorite drug, this from the World Health Organization, WHO highlights glaring gaps in regulation of alcohol marketing across borders. A new report from the World Health Organization highlights the increasing use of sophisticated online marketing techniques for alcohol and the need for more effective regulation. It shows that young people and heavy drinkers are increasingly targeted by alcohol advertising, often to the detriment of their health. Reducing the harm from alcohol by regulating cross-border alcohol marketing, advertising, and promotion is the first report from the World Health Organization to detail the full extent of the way that alcohol is today being marketed across national borders, often by digital means, and in many cases regardless of the social, economic, or cultural environment in receiving countries. Worldwide, 3 million people die each year as a result of the harmful use of alcohol, one every 10 seconds, representing about 5% of all deaths. A disproportionate number of these alcohol-related deaths occur among younger people, with 13.5% of all deaths among those who are 20 to 39 years of age being alcohol-related. Alcohol robs young people, their families, and societies of their lives and potential, said Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, Director General of the World Health Organization. Yet despite the clear risk to health, controls on the marketing of alcohol are much weaker than for other psychoactive products. Better, well-enforced, and more consistent regulation of alcohol marketing would save would both save and improve young lives across the world. One of the biggest changes in recent years to alcohol marketing is the use of sophisticated online marketing. The collection analysis of data on users' habits and preferences by global internet providers has created new and growing opportunities for alcohol marketers to target messages to specific groups across national borders. Targeted advertising on social media is especially effective at using such data, with its impact strengthened by social influencers and sharing of posts between social media users. One data source quoted in a report calculated over 70% of media spending of leading alcohol marketers based in the U.S. in 2019 was through promotions, product placement, and online advertisement in social media. Sponsorship of major sporting events at global, regional, and national levels is another key strategy used by transnational alcohol companies, which are gaining increasing dominance in the production and branding of alcohol beverages. Such sponsorship can significantly increase awareness of the brands to new audiences. In addition, alcohol producers engage in partnerships with sports leagues and clubs to reach viewers and potential consumers in different parts of the world. The increasing market of esports, including competitive gaming events, is another opportunity to sponsor events and increase brand recognition and international sales. So is product placement in movies and serials, many of which are streamed on international subscription channels. According to an analysis of the 100 highest-grossing box office U.S. movies between 1996 and 2015, branded alcohol was shown in almost half of them. The lack of regulation to address cross-border marketing of alcohol is a particular concern for children and adolescents, women, and heavy drinkers. Studies have shown that starting to drink alcohol at a young age is a predictor of hazardous drinking in young adulthood and beyond. Furthermore, teenage drinkers are more vulnerable to harm from alcohol consumption than older drinkers. Areas of the world with young and growing populations, such as Africa and Latin America, are being particularly targeted. In addition, alcohol consumption among women is an important growth sector for alcohol production and sales. While 3/4 of the alcohol that the world drinks is consumed by males, alcohol marketers tend to see the lower rate of women drinking as an opportunity to grow their market, often depicting drinking by women as a symbol of empowerment and equality. They organize corporate social responsibility initiatives. Sick, the irony. On topics such as breast cancer and domestic violence, it engages with women known for their success in areas such as sports or the arts to promote brands of alcohol. Heavy and dependent drinkers are another target for marketing efforts, since in many countries, just 20% of current drinkers drink well over half of all alcohol consumed. Alcohol-dependent people frequently report a stronger urge to drink alcohol when confronted with alcohol-related cues, yet they rarely have an effective way to avoid exposure to the content of advertising or promotion. While many countries have some form of restrictions on alcohol marketing in place, generally they tend to be relatively weak. In a WHO 2018 study, it was found that while most countries have some form of regulation for alcohol marketing in traditional media, almost half have no regulation in place for internet and social media marketing of alcohol. Meanwhile, sustained attention and work by national governments, the public health community, and the World Health Organization to limit the availability and promotion of tobacco products, with specific attention to the cross-border aspects of tobacco production and marketing, has led to life-saving reductions in global tobacco use and exposure. The report concludes that national governments need to integrate comprehensive restrictions on or bans of alcohol marketing, including its cross-border aspects, in public health strategies. It highlights key features and options for the regulation of cross-border marketing of alcohol and stresses the need for strong collaboration between states in this area. Yep, brings me back when we did a lot of tobacco control in this country and restrictions that led to sharp reductions in tobacco use. The tobacco companies went international and are doing quite well. The same is true with alcohol. Next up, story on another popular drug. This is from the American Heart Association. No health benefits among adults who use both e-cigarettes and traditional cigarettes. People who use both traditional combustible cigarettes and e-cigarettes do not reduce their risk of cardiovascular disease compared to people who exclusively use traditional cigarettes, according to new research published by the American Heart Association's flagship peer-reviewed journal, Circulation. The fact that dual use, using both traditional combustible cigarettes and e-cigarettes, had similar cardiovascular disease risk to smoking cigarettes only, is an important finding, as many Americans are taking up e-cigarettes in an attempt to reduce smoking in what they perceive as a lower risk, said Andrew Stokes, the senior author of the study. It is common for people to try to switch from traditional cigarettes to e-cigarettes and get caught in limbo using both products. Well, if you or someone you know is interested in quitting smoking, you can call the Ohio Tobacco Quit Line. That is 1-800-QUIT-NOW, 1-800-QUIT-NOW for some free help. Okay, next up, I want to report on a topic that I've covered a lot about higher suicide rates among healthcare professionals. But here's a little bit of a new one, this from MedPage Today. Pharmacist suicides outpace general public. Suicide rates among pharmacists are about one-third higher than those in the general population, according to a longitudinal analysis. Stigma often discourages pharmacists and other healthcare professionals from reporting mental health challenges. There's huge implications for healthcare professionals to admit that they have mental health, substance use disorder challenges, because they are not supposed to have that. I mean, the public doesn't want to hear that their doctor is contemplating suicide. The public does not want to hear that the person dispensing the medication has depression, but they are not immune to mental health disorders. Compared with non-pharmacists, suicide among pharmacists was more commonly associated with job problems at 77% higher risk of having job problems related to their suicide or related to the current treatment for mental illness, which is a 56% higher among pharmacists versus non-pharmacists. Well, folks, if you or anyone you know is struggling with a mental health concern or having thoughts of suicide, feel free to call the National Suicide Prevention Line at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-TALK. Okay, let's do a couple healthcare stories. This from USA Today. Government watchdog says 1 in 4 older Americans on Medicare harmed during hospital stays. 1 in 4 older Americans covered by Medicare had some type of temporary or lasting harm during hospital stays before the COVID-19 pandemic, government investigators said in an oversight report published last Thursday. The report from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General said 12% of patients had adverse events that mainly led to longer hospital stays, but also permanent harm, death, or required life-saving intervention. Another 13% had temporary issues that could have caused further complications had hospital staff not acted. An earlier Inspector General report review published in 2010 found that 27% of patients experienced some type of harm, an investigation that led to new patient safety efforts and incentives. The incremental improvements follows an intense focus on patient safety since at least 1999, when the then Institute of Medicine published To Err Is Human, a landmark report that estimated up to 98,000 deaths per year could be due to medical errors. Initiatives have since sought to improve patient safety by limiting medical errors, reducing medication mix-ups, and holding hospitals with a poor record of patient safety accountable through Medicare's program to dock the pay of the worst performers on a list of safety measures. While Inspector General investigators noted improvements in certain safety measures, officials said the 25% harm rate is concerning and deserves renewed attention from hospitals and the two federal agencies that oversee patient safety, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. Among the Inspector General's recommendations, broaden the types of complications evaluated under Medicare's pay-for-performance program. One pay-for-performance program created by the Affordable Care Act cuts 1% of Medicare pay for hospitals ranked at the bottom tier for complications such as infections, hip fractures, blood clots, bleeding, or sepsis. But of the harm examples uncovered by the Inspector General, only 5% would be complications now evaluated under Medicare's pay-for-performance program. In other words, hospitals don't face reduced payments for the vast majority of complications. The report found the most common types of harm included medication side effects. Other common issues included bed sores, surgery complications, and infections. And in more healthcare news, this from Axios, staffing shortages slam hospitals. More than 4 in 10 hospitals have seen staffing shortages limit their ability to discharge patients because of a lack of post-acute care, according to a survey provided exclusively to Axios by CarePort Health, a care coordination software company. 70% of respondents said hospital length of stay is increasing due to challenges discharging patients. Well, this next article from Medical Express is a really interesting one on the juxtaposition and the interface between chronic health conditions and drowning. 1 in 3 people who drowned in Canada had a chronic health condition, One in three people who drowned in Canada had a pre-existing medical condition that contributed to the death in almost half the cases, according to new research in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. The study analyzed all 4,288 unintentional drownings in both children and adults over 10 years from 2007 to 2016 in Canada. Researchers found that people with ischemic heart disease and seizure disorders were at increased risk. Young women with seizure disorders aged 20 to 34, while not the largest group, had a risk of drowning 23 times greater than the general population. The most common activities leading to drowning were aquatic activities such as swimming, 25%, and boating, 24%, and most often occurred in lakes or ponds, 36%. And most deaths, ranging from 63 to 84%, occurred when the person was alone or not witnessed. The majority, 81% of people who drowned were male, and about two-thirds, 63%, drowned in urban areas. Of note were the number of drownings in bathtubs in people with seizures, 53%, or neurocognitive disorders, 28%. Drowning in bathtubs is common among those with seizure disorders, as well as most other pre-existing medical conditions, writes Dr. Cody Dunn, an emergency resident physician at the University of Calgary, with co-authors. This may be an important first target for public health messaging, as it is relevant to other medical conditions, and safety planning is easier to implement than in other locations. The authors emphasize that people with seizure disorders should use a shower instead of a tub bathing, and if possible, do so when another person is home. As swimming is good for overall health and quality of life, people with ischemic heart disease who are at higher risk of drowning should not avoid swimming. Rather, the authors recommend a safe, informed approach to water activities. People with cardiovascular disease should speak with a healthcare provider before water activity, gradually increase intensity, wear a life jacket, and participate in a supervised setting or with a trained buddy, they write. So that's really fascinating. I'd never heard that connection, and it makes sense that a lot of the drownings are related to seizure disorders in bathtubs. Yikes. One more thing to pay attention to. Okay, well, next up and lastly, ended up with some better news. Our food system is really a mess, and this is some good news that we can make a difference. This from Medical Express. New and improved supermarkets trim childhood obesity in New York City. Access to newer supermarkets that offer fresh foods in some of New York City's poorest neighborhoods was linked with a 1% decline in obesity rates among public school students living nearby, a new study shows. The modernized markets were also tied to reductions of between 4 and 10% in the average student BMI-Z score, a measure of body weight based on height for each age group by gender. Although the differences were small, researchers say the results, if translated into policy changes, could have a meaningful difference if applied to the more than 14 million, 19% of American children estimated to be obese, with rates highest among Black and Hispanic children. To substantially lower death rates from related illnesses, researchers say childhood obesity rates would have to decline at least three times more than what was observed in the study. A broad health policy approach that also includes subsidies for nutritious foods, restrictions on marketing of junk foods, and warning labels could potentially make up the difference. Led by researchers at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine, the new study showed that within a year after opening of newly renovated or new supermarkets, obesity rates dropped from 24% to 23% among about 23,000 school-aged children living within a half mile of eight such stores. This reduction was compared with no change in obesity rates among over 86,000 students who resided farther away from one of the publicly subsidized stores with more space for fresh produce and perishable foods. City grants have been available since 2009 to lower the cost of renovating or opening supermarkets in the city's lowest income neighborhoods. So it is nice to see that they can actually make a difference. And while, you know, there isn't a silver bullet solution to all these problems, going one third of the way is a lot for something that is not out of reach. Obviously, one city has managed to implement it and study it and find out that it works. Yes, it is a good intervention that should be replicated. Okay, well, now it brings us to the time of the show to cover some bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment available online, just like all the stories I report on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. There's 18 today. 1. It's a tsunami. Legal challenges threatening public health policy. 2. U.S. to ask world for more on global COVID fight as its own cash dwindles. 3. Five risks if Congress does not pass new COVID-19 funding. Not enough vaccines for everyone in the fall, running out of treatments, unable to buy new treatments, shortages of tests, cutting back on global aid. 4. Strengthening Gavi is a way forward for global vaccine equity. Gavi is the international vaccination group. 5. Building scientific talent in the global south can help prevent future public health crises. Need to build up that infrastructure in the places where it's most needed. 6. The lab leak theory is looking stronger by the day. Here's what you need to know. Now, this is a podcast from The Intercept, and it was very interesting. It's not saying that we know the lab leak theory is, in fact, true, but it's a very good story of what the possibilities are. And even the fact that it may have leaked from a lab is important to know for safety and such ventures in the future. 7. This is a story that I covered a lot, but haven't covered in a long time. But as time goes, more things are uncovered. And ProPublica has a good way of laying out the story, the plot to keep meatpacking plants open during COVID-19. 8. Yes, phones can reveal if someone gets an abortion. Welcome to the surveillance state. 9. The sex ed wars will never end. 10. If Roe goes, could birth control be next? And 11. A comprehensive guide to birth control. So if you want to get a good basic backgrounder on that, that's a good one. 12. How do people with disabilities feel about abortion? A new poll sheds light for the first time. 13. To better understand women's health, we need to destigmatize menstrual blood. And this article covers about the 1 in 10 women who suffer from endometriosis. 14. Why heart disease in women is so often missed or dismissed. 15. Alzheimer's blood tests are more likely to misdiagnose black patients. And 16. Similar to the pharmacy higher rate of suicide I reported on earlier in the show, researchers try to understand high suicide rate among veterinarians. Yes, so healthcare for people, those folks have higher suicide risk, and healthcare for animals have higher risk for suicide as well. 17. This is a good news, bad news story. States move to regulate toxic chemicals. Federal government still far behind. Hopefully the states can lead the way. And 18, formula shortage, what providers are telling worried parents. If some of you or somebody you know is dealing with, this is a good set of advice. You can view these stories at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-